Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, well, you can call and we'll talk about those things. If you have a different opinion from the host and you want to talk about that, feel free to call in. In either case, the number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And the one announcement I have to make is that this is the first Wednesday of the month. We normally have a Zoom meeting on the first Wednesday night of the month, but that's not happening this month. So look for it again in January. All right, we're going to go to the phones and talk to Nelson from San Diego, our first caller today. Nelson, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, I was reading in 1 Samuel 19:20, and it's talking about Saul trying to captivate and kill David. And David was with Samuel, and Saul sent his men up to get him, and they couldn't because they were prophesying. And then even Saul went up and started prophesying and couldn't do anything. What do you suppose that means, that they were prophesying? How would that have held up anything? And what do you think that prophesying meant?
You know, prophesying is a term that's used to cover a broad number of activities, verbal activities, when the Holy Spirit would inspire somebody to speak. Obviously, the prophets are very familiar to us in the Bible. Jesus and the apostles sometimes would prophesy, telling the future. Even the book of 1 Corinthians talks about how to regulate the use of the gift of prophecy in the church meetings. But it's not always clear what prophecy looks like. Now, generally speaking, in churches that believe in prophecy today, it often takes the form of someone saying, "Thus saith the Lord," and then giving an oracle that is allegedly from God. Now, exactly how the prophets spoke in the Old Testament times is not really all that clear. Sometimes they saw visions. Sometimes they had dreams. Sometimes the word of the Lord came to them. God even mentions this in the book of Numbers, that when he speaks to a prophet, he'll give him a dream or a vision. Now, this is something he did not do with Moses. He said Moses was superior to the prophets. But there were a lot of prophets whose activities, we simply read that they prophesied, but we have no idea what it is they said or what their mental condition was when they did so. You know, did they go into a trance? Did they lose control of themselves? Well, I don't think that's normally the case. Someone like Isaiah or Jeremiah, I don't know that they went into trances or anything like that. The Bible doesn't indicate it. But that doesn't mean it never happened either. When Saul was pursuing David, the messengers that Saul sent passed through a crowd, apparently a company of prophets, and the Spirit of God came upon them, and they seemingly were distracted thoroughly and rendered incapable of their mission. They prophesied. Saul himself then came, and when he came among the prophets, he also prophesied. And there, you know, this happened a couple of times, and at least on one occasion it says he stripped off his clothes and he was laying on the ground prophesying. Now, this is the kind of thing that we would not expect to see in churches. I don't think that's the kind of thing that happened in the Corinthian church when people prophesied. But I guess it just demonstrates that when the Spirit of God comes upon a person, in addition to speaking inspired words, there can sometimes be a physical overwhelm. We know that when the people came to arrest Jesus and he said, "Who are you seeking?" They said, "Jesus of Nazareth." He said, "I am he," or "I am." And they fell over backward. It's hard to know exactly what will happen in each case. In the case of Saul, it would appear the Spirit overwhelmed him and he fell down on the ground and he was not able to pursue his mission because the Spirit overwhelmed him in such a way. Now, Paul talks about prophecy in the church as if it's something that the person speaking has control over and can stop if he's told to stop. Same thing with speaking in tongues. He says that a person wants to speak in tongues in the church, if there's no interpreter, just don't. Just don't do it. So Paul indicates that speaking in tongues and prophesying are things that are really under the control of the person who has the gift. But that doesn't mean that every time somebody in history has had the Spirit come upon them, it's been fully under their control. It looks to me, in Saul's case, it was not. Now, he prophesied. What did he say? Oh, we have no idea. We have no idea. It's like in the book of Numbers when God put his Spirit on 70 of the elders of Israel, and they began to prophesy. Well, we don't have any idea what they said. And we could be very curious to know, but we're not told. One thing we can deduce is that when they spoke things at that moment that were inspired by the Holy Spirit. And in the case of Saul and his messengers, it was an overwhelming experience. So that, at least in Saul's case, he fell down and seemed to be powerless to pursue David at that moment. So, yeah, it's a strange story because we wonder, what did they say? Why did he fall down? Why did prophesying on his part prevent him from continuing his pursuit? And we just have to take it at face value that this, you know, something, the Spirit of God overwhelmed him, interrupted him, prevented him from going any further on that particular expedition. So, we only have what we have. What I can say is, of course, that the Bible does describe prophets having different kinds of experiences when the Spirit comes to them. But we don't know the full range of experiences. We can, in the case where we have a description, as in this case, we can say, well, oh, that happened. That happened in that case. But we don't know of other cases that the same things happened in. So we're kind of just left without any more information than what's on the page.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I appreciate your thoughts on that, because I never really thought about prophesying as having that many different dimensions to it. But makes sense. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, good talking to you, Nelson. Thanks for your call. Our next caller is Steve from Eatonville, Washington. Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Hey, good afternoon, Steve. I will gladly get off the phone as soon as I ask my question and listen to the answer on the radio. But, you know, I have memorized Romans and Galatians and soon to be the book of Revelation in the King James Version of the Bible inside and out. Now, I emphasize the King James Version on purpose, and that's because when I had Romans originally memorized 22 years ago, I learned that that version is in public domain everywhere in this planet except for the UK. Now, I also know that the modern translations of the Bible, such as the NIV, ESV, NLT, are also copyrighted in this country and everywhere else. My question is, what is the significance of the King James Version of the Bible being copyrighted over in the UK and only in Britain and England? What does that actually mean? Does it mean that if I were to go over there and recite Romans and Galatians and Revelation word for word to an audience that I'm technically in violation of copyright law and could be arrested or severely fined? What about if I had modern translations memorized and titled in this country, even though many people do it? Is that also technically copyright infringement, or are they just not enforcing it right now, but they could when the Bible becomes illegal in this country, and they use that as a technicality? Anyway, just one more thing. I've recently looked up copyright infringement, and this is what the definition of at least direct infringement means, which is, when someone does something that only the copyright owner can do, such as copying the work or sharing it with the public. Every single time that I recite a book in the public, I'm sharing it. So I would really like this to be addressed, because I've learned about it for years. And I know that you're not a lawyer or anything like that, but your knowledge of legal stuff is limited. But I also know that you've written four books, two of which are heavily copyrighted. So you might know something about copyright law. And I've tried to do my own research on the Internet, but I can't find anything. So I'm hoping you might know. But I can't believe that any part of the Bible would be copyrighted in the first place. That is my actual question. Thank you very much.
All right. Steve, thanks for your call. Well, I was not aware that the King James Version is copyrighted in England, and I'm not sure how that can be. It's a book that was written hundreds of years ago. but then England is not under the same laws as America. In America, there's a limit. A copyright is good for a certain number of years. I don't remember what years that is. I think it used to be something like 46 years, and then it could be renewed for the same length of time one time. And after that, it was in the public domain, and anyone could use it any way they wanted to. I don't remember the exact laws, but it was something along those lines. I would have assumed this would be true in all of Western, lands, including England, but maybe it's not. I don't know much about British law about copyright. It is true that all the modern versions are copyrighted. And I personally don't care for that fact. Unless, of course, they simply copyrighted to protect themselves, and then they're never going to enforce it. For example, if you decided to quote from the NIV in a public forum, and let's just say you were going around doing this as a ministry, quoting these books from the NIV, well, Zondervan, I believe, owns the copyright for NIV. They could sue you or make you pay royalties or something like that. Now, not so with the King James Version. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that Zondervan would do that. I'm not sure that many Bible publishers would do that unless they felt that you were depriving them of some, profit that should be coming to them from their labor. We have to realize that the Bible itself was not written in English, and therefore every English version we have was translated by somebody's effort and expense. And you can imagine how expensive it would be to hire, dozens of linguists to spend, hours and months and maybe a year working out the best rendering of every passage in the Hebrew and the Greek. There'd be quite a payroll unless these people were doing it voluntarily, but most of these people would be, of course, like everyone else, professionals. Their time is worth something. So the NIV was translated at the expense of a publisher. The New King James was translated at the expense of a publisher. In that case, it's Thomas Nelson. The NASB was translated at the expense of the Lockman Foundation. These publishers, the Greek and the Hebrew, the information in the Bible is not theirs to copyright, but the specific wording that their paid translators came up with costs them money to produce, and it differs from other English versions in various ways. So it's their unique product, and they can copyright that. I'm not saying they should, but they could. And I don't know of anyone who's ever been sued for using a copyrighted version of the Bible, and then the publisher came after them for it. In my case, like with the book Revelation 4 Views, I have the text of Revelation throughout the book in the New King James. And on the other hand, the publisher of the New King James is Thomas Nelson. They were also the publisher of my book. So it didn't really, it was not a problem to them to use it. Getting permission from them was not a problem. But, when you do use extensive amounts of other people's published and copyrighted material, generally speaking, you should seek to get permission to use it in any way that's going to, profit you. I don't know how you're going to use your memorized material. But if you're going around just quoting it and not charging money for it, I don't see how the publishers would have any interest in suing you or giving you a cease and desist order from using their material. And what really surprises me that you say the King James Version is copyrighted in England. I don't know how it could be, but I'm not going to dispute that with you. I've never looked into that, but I wouldn't worry about it. I don't think anyone will ever sue you for quoting the King James Version of the Bible. Probably not for quoting any other one either. Steve, you still there? Oh, okay, Steve's not there anymore. I don't remember. Did he have another question? Okay, we're going to move on to the next caller. We're going to talk to Fred from Alameda, California. Fred, welcome.
Yes, I was going to elaborate on this question, but I think I'll make it concise instead. There's a verse in Proverbs, I believe, that says, train a child in the way he should go, and he shall not depart from it. Mm-hmm. My question is, does that verse suggest that a mentor or a parent can actually cause the younger person to go to hell after they die?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
You mean by training a child badly?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, yeah.
Well, I mean, certainly Jesus said whoever puts a stumbling block in front of one of these little ones who believes, it's better for that person to have a millstone put around his neck and be thrown into the sea. So it's entirely possible to have a negative influence on a child that's detrimental to his faith. And in that respect prevents him from being saved.
Would that make God unfair, though?
Would that make God unfair?
Yes.
In what sense?
Well, in other words, like, you know, why should a child's fate be put in someone else's hands? I mean, I don't believe that God's unfair, but that verse seems to suggest that an older can make the younger, can influence them to go the wrong way, and I don't quite get that.
Well, I wouldn't even think it's controversial to suggest that an older person can influence a younger person. That's, in fact, what the whole nature of the human race is. The older generation trains the younger generation. Now, if somebody in the older generation trains a child in a godly way, and that child therefore benefits from that, then that child might have we might say, unfair advantage over a child who was raised by someone who didn't train them that way. And if a child is, trained into, let's just say, wicked behavior by a wicked parent, that child certainly has a disadvantage. Now, I would say this, that at a certain point in life, every child, if they survive long enough, reaches an age where they can make choices and think for themselves, and they don't have to follow what their elders taught them. This is true even when you raise your children to be godly. When they reach an adult age, they can make their own choices. And this verse is not denying that. This verse is in the Proverbs. The Proverbs are generalities. They're not absolutes. They're not promises of God. The Proverbs is wisdom literature. It's basically saying, you want this result? Here's the wise thing to do toward getting that result. It's not guaranteed that you'll get it, but a wise man would do this if that's what he's hoping to accomplish. So if you want your kids to turn out well, a wise parent would start training them young in the right ways. If a person wants to be rich, they would be wise to start working hard and not wasting money. Now, they might work hard and not waste money and still not get rich, but a wise man who wants to get rich would pursue it in that manner. This is what Proverbs is. Proverbs is wisdom literature. And wisdom is saying, if you want this result, the smart thing to do to get it would be this, because this will tend toward that result. But it's not a guarantee. Proverbs also says if you don't want someone to be angry, you answer them with a soft answer rather than a harsh answer. Well, that's a smart thing to do if you don't want to stir up anger in someone else, answer them gently and softly. But there's no guarantee that speaking softly to someone is going to make them not be angry anymore. That's up to them. The Proverbs are not denying that people have free will. What it's pointing out is that there are certain things that incline toward other results. And you should do the things that incline toward the results you want. Now, yes, training a child to be evil will incline toward that child being evil. Training a child to be good and righteous will incline toward that child becoming that way. But still, that child's going to make his own decisions at some point. A child who dies in childhood before they can make their own rational decisions, in my opinion, even if they've done very bad things because they were trained to do so, I think they'll still be saved, because I believe that God doesn't hold children accountable until they reach an age where they know what they're doing and can make choices about the matter. We call that the age of accountability. But once a child has, let's just say a child is very badly raised, very badly trained, and therefore tends to be a criminal even when they reach an adult age, Well, that would not be surprising. However, once that child is an adult, they don't have to be a criminal. They don't have to follow their early evil training. They have a free will. They can say, this is a way that is wrong, and I'm not going to choose to go it. I'm going to choose a different course for my life. And you see this all the time. They say that, you know, let's just say two sons are raised by a father who's a woman abuser, and he models abusive behavior toward his wife. Now, those sons grow up and get married. One of them just follows his father's example and abuses his wife. The other one says, I don't want to have a home like my dad had. I don't want to abuse my wife. I'm going to not do what my father did. I'm going to do something better. Well, these two sons both had the same example, the same training, as it were, in their early childhood, but they can make choices which way they're going to go. So God is never unfair. God will not hold you responsible for things you have no choice about. But once you're an adult, you have the choice. And, yeah, you're at something of a disadvantage if, even when you've reached the age where you have a choice, you've always been conditioned from childhood to make bad choices. You're obviously at a disadvantage from that person who was trained from childhood to make good choices. And it will be harder. It'll be harder for the first child to make the right choices. But hard, everybody finds it hard to make the right choices sometimes. We're all up against different obstacles, and God knows what those are. You know, if I was raised in a Christian home and I was trained to be, you know, to live a good life, a righteous life, and for the most part, that's how I've lived my life. And I haven't found it that difficult for the most part either. It's just, you know, the way I was trained. But someone else who's trained just the opposite, to be a monster of iniquity, but they still try to choose to do right, they may not end up doing right as much as I do because I had the advantage of an upbringing that made it easier for me. But God takes that into consideration. He might blame me more for my smaller infraction, since I have less excuse for it, then he blames that person for their larger infractions, because he knows the struggles that they've had and the obstacles they're up against. God is just, and he knows that some people have had a harder situation than others. He knows it's more difficult for some to make the right choices because of their childhood conditioning and so forth than others. And God doesn't leave those things out of consideration when he judges. But ultimately, he judges us for the choices we make and the things we do. And that's what the Bible says. So, the proverb is not saying that if you train a child badly, he will inevitably be a bad child. But it does suggest that the influence upon a child from parents or whoever's raising them is a very significant factor in the likelihood that they will do well when they get older. So that is what I believe Proverbs is saying there. Remember, Proverbs is not a book of promises. It's not prophetic. It's not prophesying that this will happen. It is basically, as it claims to be, a book of wisdom. And wisdom is saying, okay, here's an objective. How do we get there from here? Okay, the wise course that will tend toward that objective would be X. And any other course would not tend toward that objective. So the wise one will choose this way. And that's what wisdom means, and that's what the book of Proverbs is. All right? So I hope that helps clarify that subject. But God will judge each person knowing full well what the disadvantages are that they've labored under. But none of us should exaggerate the disadvantages that we think we've been under. Because Peter says in 1 Peter, when he's talking about how the devil's trying to ruin us all, he says, but you know that the same afflictions are accomplished by everyone in the world. That is, we might say, well, it's hard for me to do good because I had these bad influences in my life. Yeah, but almost everyone had bad influences in their life, so don't think you're so special. God knows, and what he expects of all of us is a rather heroic determination not to repeat the sins of our parents or of the influences we had in our early life. And those who put out that effort and who are determined to follow Christ, I believe that's him. I think he's impressed with that. I think he has. I think that's a positive thing that he will take consideration of. But he also knows, again, the handicaps or the disadvantages that we've had. We don't. So we should just do all we can to be righteous and follow Christ as best we can, and leave the judgment of our situation in God's hands. Hey, we need to take a break. We have another half hour coming. Our lines are full. We'll be talking to these callers in the next half hour. We just take a brief break here, saying The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. We're at the end of the year, and at the end of each year, we decide which radio stations we will continue to stay on. We've been on the radio for going on 28 years now. But we do every year have to decide if we're going to keep all the stations we're on now, or if we'll have to drop some, or if we'll be able to add some. This all has to do with the money we have on hand. And we have no advertisements, no sponsors, nothing for sale. We just have what listeners send in. If you'd like to help us promote the ministry into the next year, feel free to write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be right back. Don't go away.
Take The Narrow Path with you everywhere on your phone or other device by downloading our app from the App Store or from Google Play. You can listen to the radio broadcasts live or later from the app, as well as many other lectures posted at our website. Search for the app by typing the same name as the website, The Narrow Path, and enjoy the learning experience. It's rare to get such good stuff for free these days.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you want to discuss the point of difference of opinion with the host that you have, feel free to give me a call. The number is 844-484-5737. Before the break, I mentioned that our lines are full. They were, but over the break, one of the callers dropped off, so there's now a line open. If you want to call in at this time, the number is 844-484-5737. And our next caller is Shannon from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Shannon. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yes. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. this is my first time calling in, and I wrote down everything, so it'll be hopefully more expedient for you.
That's great. Yeah, good idea.
Thank you. I'm in a relationship with my son's father, Billy, whom we've had a relationship off and on for 26 years. My oldest daughter, not his daughter, but she's 26. So when we first met 26 years ago, he was married but separated. And that separation had nothing to do with me. He was just already separated. So he and Dee got a divorce. This was his first marriage. After about seven years later, he came back into town, and he came back into my life, and we had a son together. So he didn't marry me. When our son was three, he got married to another woman for about 2 years and then divorced her. So now we are trying to mend fences and explore our relationship. But it's not that we're just now trying to. We've kind of been off and on. It's just been difficult, you know. But now we are trying to mend fences and treat each other better and have a relationship. So he's...
Why didn't he marry you when he got you pregnant before?
Well, he didn't want to. He said that, you know, it made me feel like I wasn't good enough. He said that I I lived in a zoo. I just wasn't raised like him. He had a mother and father, very whatever life, and I'm just not. I would have to change everything about me to make him happy. And I'm just kind of making it real short, but that's pretty much what it was. My lifestyle was different than his.
And has that changed? Does he want to marry you now?
Well, he's, let me tell you the problem. Yes and no. Okay, so he married another woman, got divorced. So after that, we were still seeing each other all these 15 years, and we never got along well. And he's a Christian, I'm a Christian, so basically it was like fornication. Well, like maybe 8 years ago, it really hurt me a lot. So I finally figured out, well, when he comes to see our son, you know, he has to get a hotel. He can't stay at my house, and I'm not going to his hotel. And he lives 300 miles away. I'm in Fort Worth. He's in Midland, Texas, so it worked. So I didn't sleep with him for like 7 years, and I kind of started healing and all that. And by the way, in between that time, he found out he was bipolar. So
let me jump in here, Shannon, because
so
obviously
it's a big mess.
Yeah, obviously this is many years long, with a lot of complications. What are you wondering right now? What are you asking me?
Let me tell you. Okay, so he, according to Matthew 5, 31, 32, and 1 Corinthians 7, 10, and 11, it says that, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with Christ saying that, you know.
I am. What is the question? Yeah.
Well, he feels that he cannot remarry because, or he would have to go back to his first wife. Okay.
So he's had one wife. He's had one wife for a couple of years, whom he divorced.
Yes.
Okay.
And then another wife that he divorced.
Okay. And what have these wives done since they've been divorced? Have they gone on and had other men?
I'm sure they have.
Yeah. If they have, then as far as I'm concerned, his marriage is over. He's probably cheated on them, and they've cheated on him, and therefore there's been adultery all over the place. And I'd say every party in those marriages has grounds for divorce. So I, you know, not that I recommend divorce. I just say that if someone says, do they have any right to divorce and to be free from those marriages, it sounds like it because everyone's been misbehaving so much. But I would say that I'm not sure why you would give him serious consideration. He's married. He got you pregnant and didn't want to marry you because you weren't good enough for him.
Then he married another woman,
and apparently she wasn't good enough for him either. He divorced her. Then he married again, and apparently he divorced her because she wasn't good enough either. I don't know if anyone's good enough for him. Frankly, I would put it the other way. I'm not sure he's good enough for anybody. He doesn't strike me as a man. Any man who goes around making babies and leaving the mom behind to raise them is not a man that I would have any respect for, and not a man that I would consider a Christian. He may call himself a Christian, but a Christian means something. It means somebody who's following Christ, and a person who's going around, you know, sleeping with women, getting them pregnant, leaving them behind, marrying them, and then leaving them behind, marrying another one, leaving them behind, that doesn't strike me as a man who's following Christ, because following Christ means doing what Christ said. So I think he's coming back around to you because he's getting lonely again after divorcing his last wife. And if I were you, I wouldn't trust him. He doesn't strike me as a trustworthy man. If you feel like he has changed, and I don't know that there's any, I have no idea, but I mean, people can change, but I wouldn't trust that he has changed until I'd seen an awful lot of evidence of that. He seems to be the kind of person who kind of just takes what he wants, as long as he wants it, and then leaves it behind to leave others to suffer the consequences. I'm not impressed with this man in any way, and or by his claiming to be a Christian. So I would say I wouldn't
well,
do it.
I know he's
the father of your son, but your son's grown up now, and so you don't have to be with the father of your son by any means. And I would. If I were you, I'd make sure that I was living solidly for God and hold out for a man who's got a track record of living solidly for God. Because men who don't have a track record of following God, it's awfully hard in today's world to expect that they will be good husbands. They might be. A man who's been a lousy person.
He may
become a very solid Christian and a very reliable husband. But if he's only been a Christian a short time, and most of his life before that he's been, an alley cat, I would be very cautious about trusting that he's fully changed. I'd want to wait for a long time, observe him in lots of situations. But frankly, you could probably do better. I don't know. But in any case, when he said you weren't good enough for him back 26 years ago, I think it was the other way around. I think he wasn't good enough for you, and he still may not be. Listen, I can't spend the rest of the time with you because my lines are full and we only have a limited time on the air. But I would just say, frankly, assuming that he and his former wives have all committed adultery, I think they're all free from those marriages because of adultery. But I wouldn't encourage you to enter into a relationship with him. He's been coming and going, and you haven't been getting along with him most of that time, I think you said. I'm sure you're lonely and stuff, but it's a good thing that you're resolved not to stay in his hotel to have him over to your house. He doesn't strike me as a man who's good for you or anybody that I know of, any woman, until he can decide that he's going to be a holy man and live a righteous life. A man who doesn't have that commitment, well, he may end up being an okay husband, but there's just no guarantees. Anyway, I need to take another caller. I'm sorry to hear about your drama, but your son is an adult now, as I understand it. So that shouldn't make you bound at all to his father in any way. I'd just treat his father like any other man that might have an interest in courting you, and evaluate him on his merits or demerits, and have nothing to do with him if he doesn't strike you as a man who's going to be godly and trustworthy. I appreciate your call. I'm sorry that you've been through what you have. Let's talk to Eddie from Tennessee. Eddie, welcome.
Yes. I just had a question over in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 7. It says that at the end of 1,000 years, the devil would be released from prison for a while. I wonder if we've reached that point yet.
If we've reached that point yet where Satan is released for a while, well, it does say that at the end of that time, Satan will be released for a little while to go out and deceive the nations. And we can say this, that the nations do exhibit a great deal of darkness and blindness and deception, which makes it a possibility that this is such a time as that. But I'm not sure how we could be certain, because every season in history, the nations have been largely full of sin and darkness. I mean, there's never really been a time when most of the nations of the world have lived according to God's light. And therefore, through almost all periods of history, the nations are, in some measure, deceived by Satan. Obviously, I think that in Revelation 20 and verse 7, the deception that is spoken of there is unprecedented. I believe it's a higher degree of deception than at ordinary times. And I do believe that in some sectors of this world, deception has reached heights or depths, we might say, that are somewhat unparalleled in history. Though I'm not sure that some of that might not be swinging back, and I don't know. Societies do go through pendulum swings. And, the last 4 years or more, we've seen some really awful results of the devil's deception in the gender movement some of these other things where people have been really deceived to their own detriment. On the other hand, we could say it's a cultural phenomenon that's now swinging back the other way. because it does seem like the radical gender movement does not have the approval that it had a year ago in Western countries. So there's lots of different kinds of deception, obviously, and we've seen a lot of it in modern times. But I don't know if we'll ever be able to know for sure if we're living at that particular time that's described, because there have been dark times. There have been dark times through much of history, and in some cases they go through, they swing the other way for a while. And there are revivals, for example, which could happen again. So I can't really argue that this is or is not that time that Revelation mentions. I can understand the question arising, because things are pretty wacko. But I could just say maybe. I guess that's the most I could say about it, is the answer is a good, firm maybe.
Okay, well, thank you, and I appreciate that. The way I understand it, when Christ, we started living in the millennial, it's when Christ was first come. He bound Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he died on the cross, then we spiritually live with him now, I guess, and I always thought that millennial was just something, just a symbol of what we're living now.
Yeah, my understanding is that it's symbolic for the present age. That's obviously not the most popular view today, but it is the most widely held view in Christian history. Most Christians have held that view. Most Christians today don't seem to, but, of course, we can't judge a view's validity by how many people believed it at any given time. I agree with you on that, and because of that, I do expect that the releasing of Satan for a little while at the end of that period does remain in our future, if it has not already come. But I have no certainty that it has come. So unless I had some way of knowing that it had come, I'm going to just look at that as still anticipated. Thank you, brother. I appreciate your call. We'll talk next to Earl from Eugene, Oregon. Earl, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Oh, hi, Steve. You're answering the question about the copyright. I'm opening my New Cambridge Paragraph Bible, and it says, rights in the King James Version, authorized King James Version of the Bible, are vested in the crown, and there's some kind of royal seal underneath that, and this one's printed under the royal letters patent. So there is something to that, but unless you're printing a whole Bible, I'd say not to worry about it, because nobody gets in trouble with it. But if you're printing a whole Bible, you might have to worry about something like that, but I don't think that's the case. I found generally for other more modern copyrights, generally they allow you up to 500 verses in any work. A book like you wrote, you could quote 500 verses and not be in trouble. If you quote more, you'd have to get written permission. Or if you use whole book of the Bible, you'd have to get written permission. But that's just general. I'm not a lawyer. My objection has to do with Psalm 50, those who take God's word in their mouth. God's word is not given to make money for God, because God owns the cattle on a thousand hills. So like if you take Psalm 23, I believe it says in the King James, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The New King James says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Any formal equivalent Bible says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. I'm not superstitious. I can memorize the King, the 23rd Psalm, verse 1, in any of those versions. But if they start using more verses, they'll run into copyright infringement, and so they have to change it slightly, which interferes with my memorization. Psalm 50 says the word of God is for praising God and to memorize it, to keep one's vows. And it's easier for me to do that if I just stick with the King James Version and not be superstitious. And
Well, most of the Bible memorization that I have done was in the King James. I suppose most memorization I did was when I was a young man, and the King James was the only Bible I carried. Not because I considered it to be the only good version, but because it was the most accessible version. And the people I was around used it, so I just used it. But I don't care what version a person uses. But I did think it was, like you said, if they change it, then what you memorized has changed. One thing I thought is that if you memorize in the King James, I'm not saying people should or should not, I'm just saying that if you do memorize in the King James, that's as long as the King James is around, it will not change, you know, unless the Mandela effect, you know, happens that people talk about, which is ridiculous in my mind. But if you memorize in the NIV, well, eventually the NIV might not be very much used anymore. It might be the ESV replaces it. But if you memorize in that, maybe it's going to be the CBS version, CSB version. It's like with new versions coming out all the time. Which one do you want to memorize? The one that's a fad for everyone to read right now may be displaced by another version that becomes the fad for everyone to use in the future. Whereas if you use the King James, it's been around for 400 years and it's probably going to be around another 400 years. That doesn't make it the best version. I'm not a King James only, but I do like the idea of if I'm going to memorize a whole book, and I did that when I was younger for a few books of the Bible, I want to do it in a version that will still be around and people still be using someday. In the future. Anyway, those are side issues. The bit about the King James being the property of the crown, I guess that doesn't surprise me since it was put out by, you know, the crown 400 years ago or so, but I hadn't really thought about it before, that they had sort of something like rights to it. Anyway, I appreciate your information. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk to Sabrina, from California. Sabrina, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
There are three things I'm doing in my life right now. The first thing, I started a chronological Bible online, and I've been doing it every day, and I'm on day 337 right now. I'm in the New Testament. Super exciting. The second thing, I listen to you anytime I'm in my car at 2 p.m., even if I'm not going somewhere. I'm trying to make it either I go on your website or your Narrow Path app, and I listen to, like, the latest episode series, so I really try to do that. And then the third thing, I started watching the series Chosen, which is why I'm calling you. It's so good to me, and I think it's because it's about the Testament, it's about the life of Jesus, and a few people that I know told me not to watch it, and I value your opinion and want to know your thoughts, because I feel like it's really getting me a glimpse at, you know, I think it's based on the Bible, but I just want to know your thoughts, if you're familiar with it and what you think about that.
Okay. Oh, by the way, that you're going through a chronological Bible is a good thing. I think those are helpful. You may be aware we have a link at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under resources and links. A friend of ours worked for years putting together and improving every year a chronological Bible, which is available at our website that people might be interested in if they're looking for one.
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
With the new year coming up, sometimes people resolve to read through the Bible, you know, beginning of the year, right?
Yep.
So anyway, as far as The Chosen is concerned, I haven't watched The Chosen much. I did finally, because people talked about it so much, I did watch the first season. I don't think I've seen any of the other seasons, which means I can't really comment on them. I can tell you what I thought about the first season. Now, the later seasons may have been better or worse than the first. I can't answer to that. It seemed to me that The Chosen was sufficiently reverent, sufficiently influenced by the New Testament in its general storyline. Of course, it added a great deal to the storyline, and the parts it added were mostly not about Jesus, but about his disciples. It seemed to me like The Chosen is mostly about the lives of the disciples, and Jesus is kind of a thread that's kind of woven through there because they're his followers. But there's a lot of backstory of the disciples, a lot of, you know, relational intrigues and dynamics between them and so forth, which aren't in the Bible at all. I mean, we don't know much of anything about the backstories of any of the disciples. So that means it's a fictional account, and they don't pretend to be otherwise. By the way, the people who made The Chosen, they wouldn't deny it. It's a fictional story. Most of what Jesus said in the Chosen was either something that is in the New Testament, in the first season I saw, is something that either is in the New Testament or is at least not disagreeable with something Jesus would probably say. The depiction of Jesus by Jonathan Rumi is, I guess I kind of like it. I mean, I kind of like the character, the way he's portrayed Jesus. But my general feeling was I wasn't very interested in watching the other seasons. And that's because so much of it was just straight imagination, you know. And I'm not saying that we can't sit around and imagine what the disciples were like and what they talked about, you know, off the record, you know, which isn't mentioned in the scripture. To imagine such things is not a problem to me. I just don't have any interest in what someone else imagines they said. I have other resources to study Jesus and that, especially the Bible itself. So I'm not a big fan of dramatizations of Bible stories. Never have been. That doesn't mean they're bad. I'm not saying this is an evil thing or bad. I'm just saying I've never been very satisfied with any depiction on film of any of the stories of the Bible that have been done through my lifetime. There have been a lot of them. And I always wonder why they don't stick closer to the text. I like the Bible. I like the truth. I'm not saying that the fictionalized parts are contrary to the truth. They're just not, they're not of the same value as those parts that are part of the truth. So I'm not the one to ask. I mean, as far as just giving a good critical evaluation of it as a piece of art, I haven't really watched it that much. But you know, I'd much rather meditate on the Gospels themselves, because then I know I'm that's the truth, and it's as I do that that I will really see Jesus as he is. I'm not saying that Jonathan Rumi in The Chosen doesn't do a pretty good job in many respects of depicting the character of Christ. I never fully trust any actor, well-intentioned as he may be, to be a perfect representation of Christ when he's playing Christ. And so it's just my own idiosyncrasies. I've just never much liked theatrical representation of the Bible stories. All right.
Okay, that's fair. Fair answer.
All right. God bless you, Sabrina.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I don't have much time. Daniel from Fort Worth, Texas, if you can use a minute, then we've got that just about. Go ahead.
So it's a quick question. It's regarding the Israelites that built the golden calf, the idolatry.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if that's an image that may have adopted from their time in Egypt.
Almost certainly. Yeah, almost certainly.
Okay.
Yeah, the bull was one of the deities of the Egyptians.
I kind of thought so. Thank you so much, Steve.
Yeah, it was probably modeled after something they'd seen there.
All right.
Daniel.
Thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. All right, well, just in time. The music's playing and we're out of time. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you're not familiar with the program and you're curious to know more about it, we're on every day at this same time, weekdays, have been for about going on 28 years now. And there are archives of the program you can listen to for free going back many years at our website, as well as thousands, or at least over 1,000, of my lectures teaching verse by verse through the Bible and on hundreds of biblical topics. They're all free to listen to or download from our website, thenarrowpath.com. Everything at the website is free, and we sell nothing. But we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Have a good evening.